About 12 years ago, I was walking with Al Rusink down this aisleway right here, over here, and I told him that because I was being interviewed to come here, and I told him I followed the lectionary, and I remember him turning to me and said, "Well, I hope if something happens that you need to change, you won't think twice about doing it." And this week, the lectionary reading, which is just fine for the first Sunday of Lent, just didn't fit. And so I changed to a very ugly story. And my lips are burning this morning, but I don't think it's because of what I'm going to say. I'm making a stew, and I cut up a pepper a little bit ago, and then I touched it, and then I touched my lips. I'm assuming it's not just a metaphor. I realize that I am horrified, but I also recognize I'm not helpless. That I am sad, but I am not seduced into quietness. I'm old, relatively speaking, but I think I have the strength to persevere into my end. I don't want to do and say what needs to be said because it's so ugly, and the reality is so dreadful and appalling, but I do recognize that a beautiful statue begins most often from a dour, chunk of clay, or an unpolished, roughly cut piece of stone. Do you remember Roy Moore? Roy is that country boy populist down in Alabama. He enjoys and finds meaning breaking norms that seem to irritate the so-called establishment when he breaks those. Moore is the two-time state Supreme Court justice from Alabama who commissioned that huge block of stone to be carved with the Ten Commandments and then placed in the rotunda of the state capitol building. It was, in the end, forcibly removed by federal troops for complicating the time-tested standard that we seek to enshrine in our hearts, that thing that we call the separation of church and state. And he was also, as it turns out, removed from the bench, not once, but twice. And he ran for an open position in the U.S. Senate just a little bit ago. During that campaign, he was accused of being sexually and relationally oriented toward young adolescent girls when he was serving as a 30-year-old lawyer. Now, these were allegations, but they did come from fairly credible sources, and the stories were well known, it seems, by a wide variety of cross-referencing people over a long number of years. But alas, we live in a time when a politician denying something simply makes it true. What you may not remember is that during the campaign, in order to seek to demonstrate that he was a safe man with young girls, his campaign staff had him interviewed by a 13-year-old Alabama girl in pigtails. She did a fine job, incidentally. She was articulate, she was well-versed in the questions that she asked. But please, who in their right mind would put a child, an innocent child, an innocent young woman or boy, man, on stage with such a person? She was not, incidentally, one of those 13-year-old going on 22-year-old looking girls. She was a young kid with innocence and gullibility just spread all over her face. Who would sacrifice their daughter in light of what was being said about Moore? I have a daughter, and I can tell you, I told her more often than not that such people exist, and I told her it is an apt metaphor, this thing about wolves in sheep clothing. Any abuser worth his or her salt is not going to directly abuse a child on stage. It's called grooming. An abuser will take days, if not months, grooming someone to trust them just so that he can abuse the relationship of trust that has been established. And we know that abusers like Harvey Weinstein and others have whole organizations surrounding them that support the abuser over the victims. And then, of course, abusers have often been just relocated to a new location, and the abuse just happens over and over again. If you will allow me the generalization, in society, which is us. We have long tolerated putting our children at risk rather than demanding that abusers and the organizations that support them be dismantled and punished and our children made safe. It is nearly incomprehensible, but a true reality that just happens over and over and over again. Incidentally, I believe children when they say they are abused. Children do not lie about bad things that happen to them. They might not be able to say it clearly what has happened to them because they don't have the accurate words and concepts yet to describe physical and sexual abuse. Kids don't make up abuse stories. If an abuser is any good at all, they will confuse a child forcefully into saying things that don't make sense. Once a child has been abused, we should expect confusion and timidity. Because if they have finally spoken up, they have been told to expect the most horrible things will happen by telling the truth. It is a wicked web of pathology that children are forced to live with as they are abused. Do children lie? Sure. Do children pathologically lie? As a general rule, no. Do children lie to protect someone they have loved who has hurt them? Of course. We need to remember, in our quest to keep our children safe from stranger danger, that a vast majority of children are abused in the home or at school by a known and trusted person, and that children will cover for them as long as they can. So yes, children will lie for as long as they can about it because they are caught in that confusing matrix of love and trust and hurt and shame. Let me be clear, there are kids who pathologically lie, but they're fairly well recognized and represent less than 1% of all kids. 99% of the time, our kids are telling us the truth as they are able to express it. And many times, by the time our kids can tell us the whole truth, the ugly realities, those bad things have been happening for a very long time. We do all of our kids a favor when we teach them at age-appropriate levels what is abusive, what is hurtful, and what words to use if someone ever does something to them that makes them uncomfortable or hurts them. It does not harm their innocence to know that they will be loved by telling us the truth and that we will believe them when they tell us. None of us want to believe that our dad, our uncle, our coach, teacher, or favorite neighbor is an abuser, but the only way to end the abuse of our children is to believe it happens and to be ready to tackle it head on when it does happen to someone we love. Can you imagine when the 13-year-old that was psychologically coerced into interviewing Roy Moore, how she will question one day why she was made to interview a well-known abuser of young girls? Her sense of safety and stability are on serious grounds of fluidity by what her parents required her to do. She and her parents, however, were all abused by that larger abusive system. She was a child sacrificed in a failed attempt to get a man into the U.S. Senate. Child sacrifice is biblical. Most of the time when the biblical lectionary includes that reading that we just had from Abraham and Isaac, I just don't use it. And then for the however many times it's been this year, we had yet another child sacrifice, children sacrificed in Parkland, Florida, and I could not avoid going to read it myself, a scripture that is just so detestable. But the death of our children is even more so. Why are we so willing to sacrifice our children repeatedly to death by gun violence in their schools? First, about the story in Genesis. I'm going to back up. Just allow me a little thing. When I do sermons, I do my sermon preparation, and it happens in a part of me. I'm a split personality, okay? Multiply. It happens over here, and then when I give sermons, it comes from over here. And a lot of times, standing here, it's the first time that they come together in my psyche. I don't enjoy doing these. I don't enjoy being cohesive. First, about the story in Genesis. It probably was a reality in those ancient Near Eastern communities that child sacrifice was practiced by certain groups. Child sacrifice is sadly a reality in many ancient religions the world over. The Abraham-Isaac story is probably about the evolution of people's beliefs about human sacrifice. But seriously, in 2018, the United States of America, we still openly and easily allow the wholesale slaughter of the most innocent ones because of an outdated Second Amendment to our Constitution that is worshiped by, like a god, by over half of our country. And the story in Genesis about Abraham and Isaac is about child sacrifice coming to an end. Over 4,000 years ago, it had grown to be understood, child sacrifice, as barbaric. And the story says that the need to sacrifice was modified by using a sheep rather than a child. Still pretty ugly at times, but I'm still more in favor of it that way. I would like to suggest that this story in Genesis is a made-up story. But sadly, tragically, probably is most likely not made up. There are so many tragic elements in the story, but notice with me, go back and read it later, that Abram and Isaac do not go back down the mountain together, and never again are they in a relationship that is noted in the biblical literature. They were most likely torn asunder by what happened on the mountain that day. Abram risked killing his child, and his child was forever separated from him in a caring and loving manner. When I ponder the adults who staged that young girl with Roy Moore, this story informs me as to their most probable future. There is one poignant moment of the last couple of days that I hope that I and we never forget. A mother of one of the slaughtered girls was given a microphone, and she screams into the camera her grief and her pain, and she demands for guns and justice to be, those guns to be removed from harming our children. When I saw her on live television, I saw them hand her that microphone. I fell back into my chair, and I steadied my nerves for that blast of pain that I was about to see and hear. She is screaming the agonizing reality of her pain, saying that she has just spent the last 2 hours preparing for a funeral for her 14-year-old daughter, asking us, demanding us, what are we going to do? Not for her daughter, but for preventing that from ever happening again. She was brilliant. When Abram took off with Isaac to Mount Moriah to offer his son as a sacrifice, don't you think that Sarah, his wife, did the same thing to him? Did he go home alone without his son? Because you know that she was not finished with him yet. How can we allow this tearing of the basic trust between ourselves as adults and our children to continue? We are abusing them. And we have a Congress full, a state assembly full of abusers who are protecting their fellow abusers. We should be screaming like that mother who just lost her child to gun violence. And if we're not, then we are silent and we are complicit. I stopped the sermon there and got up a couple hours later and decided, oh, you got to say something else. Last year, researchers from around the country reviewed about 130 studies from 10 countries on gun control for epidemiological reviews. This is, for now, to my knowledge, the most current extensive review of the research on the effects of gun control. The findings were clear. And I quote, "The simultaneous implementation of laws targeting multiple firearms restrictions is associated with reductions in firearm deaths," end quote. The study did not look at one specific intervention, but rather a wide variety of gun control, from licensing measures to buyback programs. And time again, they found the same line of evidence. Reducing access to guns was followed by a drop in deaths related to guns. And while non-gun homicides also decreased, the drop wasn't as quick as the one seen in gun-related homicides, indicating that access to guns was a potential causal factor. Based on the other research, this actually isn't a very surprising finding, is it? Regularly updated reviews of the evidence compiled by the Harvard School of Public Health's Injury Control Research Center have consistently found that while controlling for variables such as socioeconomic factors and other crime, places with more guns have more gun deaths. 17 people are killed in a school by an expelled student who had a semi-automatic rifle, a weapon capable of firing a round per second, and countless magazines of ammunition. And our president called for no action. In Las Vegas, 58 people were killed and hundreds wounded by a sniper using bump stocks that let him fire semi-automatic rifles at near automatic weapon rates of fire. And again, the president called for no action. Thoughts and prayers are lovely, aren't they? They can make us feel better. They can even have power to heal. I'm not recommending we get rid of them. But they do nothing to get governments to take action to prevent other tragedies. Two people are killed by a drunk driver up here on Interstate 70 who happened to be undocumented, and Trump fired out an ultimatum calling for immediate action. The part of me that is drawn to hopelessness just wants to give up. But I decided with some other people that I'm giving up hopelessness for Lent. It is absurd, since the Sandy Hook Elementary School shootings, that another 1,600 plus children have been sacrificed. At least Abram didn't sacrifice his child. We still do. We don't need to have yet another relatively polite courthouse walk. I'm not against them. But we need to block traffic. We need to block commerce. And hold church, all churches, perhaps, hold church out in the middle of 3rd Street, demanding change. We need to give the Bloomington Police Department opportunity to use their new bulletproof vehicle against a group of people who have no guns and who are demanding not a little change, but a total change in gun laws. We must give up hopelessness for Lent and take over the state that we were so fortunate that Pence left for Washington, D.C. The government can arrest a few people, but not all of us. What are we willing to do for our children's welfare? Bloomington is certainly not exempt from gun violence. Laws change all the time, but not without a force of the many demanding that they change. Are you willing to sacrifice any more children? There is a movement afoot for school children to not go to school for one day. God bless them. But why should children have to lead that effort? Why are not all of us blocking access to schools for them? Why are we not blocking access to commerce on a regular basis, demanding action? Why are not IU students and faculty all out on the bypass on 3rd Street in downtown, blocking it with 40 to 50,000 people, demanding change in the laws and letting the effort spread to every campus so that a national shutdown day occurs, so that we are no longer sacrificing our children to gun deaths. Amen. I got two lines left. My daughter works in a school. My granddaughter goes to a school, and they're not safe. I'm fairly personally invested. You, a disciple of Jesus, a follower of his way, will not tolerate this sitting out and not being a participant.